Welcome to Business Second Opinion with Carol Sanford, a respected thought leader in the world of business design for growing people in order to grow your business. She always offers a contrarian view on what sacred temples of wisdom such as the Harvard Business Review advise. Her approach is based on living systems research and her four decades of practice with Fortune 500 companies and rockstar entrepreneurs. I'm Zach Swartout, and I'm your host. Today, Carol's going to be giving a business second opinion on psychological safety, team health, and team dynamics. She's going to be looking at the article entitled High-Performing Teams Need Psychological Safety. Here's How to Create It by Laura Delazana from the August 2017 article in the Harvard Business Review. Welcome, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
So what are some of the premises of this article that Ms. Delazana is putting forth for us today?
Well, let's talk about kind of the overarching idea that looks like it triggered her doing this. There's a study that Google did and was trying to understand why when they had high-performing teams, some of them seemed to work really well. So now you would say, all right, if Google did it, it must be accurate. The challenge is that the worldview you start with actually flavors what you can see. And there's something very strange happening here, which is in the case of Google, it's always been you step in, take 20% of your time, move up to something, take it on. And it has been kind of a cultural norm that people did that and some things would work and some others wouldn't. But when they decided to study it, they came back with the opinion, and I will argue that it has a lot to do with the questions they asked and what they looked at, that if people didn't feel psychologically safe, they didn't take risk. So one can understand why this could become a piece of literature, because it's not a really strong, I don't think, well-constructed study, but helping people overcome what often in many companies is the fear of punishment. And how do you have people feel like they can be safe so that they can innovate, they can take risks, and not have shortfalls? So let's talk about how this article is constructed based on that one little piece. One study is based on what I would call an amelioration of the fear that happens to people, which often happens to all of us. We all become afraid at various times. But the entire article is based on the idea that the organization needs to ameliorate the culture, the conditions around them so that people are not ever made afraid. That's a little bit like saying to me, make sure your children never touch germs so they don't get sick because they don't build an immune system to the kind of germs that we now know they need to be playing with. The idea that we would protect and build cultures where managers try and manage the relationship to keep fear from entering. So, for example, they say, try and anticipate any reactions that you might trigger as a manager. This is always one of your questions, right, Zach?
Yeah.
How do I, as a manager, do something
exactly
with this? So they are saying, anticipate any fear you might evoke and plan counter moves. Now, if you just listen to that for a minute, it becomes clear that we've got an external idea about where the responsibility is for what it is that we're helping people work on. And it's actually a manipulative process. Figure out what they're going to say, manipulate and move, help them not become afraid. You're going to hear in a minute why that drives me crazy. And it's not a very healthy way to build much of anything for a business or a family. One more, and then let's see if these are making sense to you. The other thing that they suggest is to try and replace any experience going in that people would feel at all like you might be blaming them. And then just walk in and sound like you're curious. I'm just kind of curious. How did that go? Do you have any idea how we got to where we are, why it didn't work? And you come in, and I mean, as I say it, it feels so artificial. If you don't have a work design that supports this, then these are what I'd call programmatic interventions designed to manipulate the experience of people. So I am still back to the idea that we would externally manage the environment and the relationship to me, is undermining the very idea of innovation. What do you think about those two? Did you have any more questions about those, or they make sense?
They made sense. I think that as you were talking, the thing that I heard in there in the language that's getting used in the article is it sounds almost competitive. I'm imagining myself having to play chess to anticipate the person's next move in front of me rather than actually being alongside the person. It feels like I'm competing against them or something like that. Is that kind of what you're pointing to?
Well, that certainly could be if you have people in the organization who are competitive, but this is also true if you're trying to get the manager to manage it for them. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny. I think in some ways they're trying to say here, reduce the competitiveness. Mm-hmm. But in some sense, because we have a boss or a manager trying to manage either a lower manager or a solo contributor, it's going to feel like if the whole context doesn't support this kind of culture, it's going to feel a little strange. Let me try a couple more here that are the premise that are inside of this. They suggest being a collaborator, like we're in this together, rather than what I would call is what you really want to move toward is more like a co-creator of something for something external. This entire process is beginning to look like it is the way we're trying to be employee-centric, like we put the employee in the center and we make it really work for them. They suggest something else like a human-to-human kind of relationship. You and me, let's talk. And I know you want to come out and feel successful and happy, and so do I. And again, I think the intention behind these are good because we know that having people are fearful is a real problem. But I actually do not think that's the way you go to get there. And there's one last thing they suggest, just so we have all their premises on the table, that in addition to try and assess what you're going to do, you do feedback. How did I do? You try and disarm them, it says. And that process of trying to disarm somebody is, again, a manipulative process. It's not being fully present and open. It's a technique to ameliorate what normally is bad that's going on. And just on top of that, why don't you do a survey to check what people think? I'm not going to go into all I think about surveys right now. We'll do that on another podcast. But the challenge here is we've got six premises in this, all of which I call trying to ameliorate and fix things for the people that might feel psychologically unsafe.
Okay, got it. That is helpful. Thank you for clearing that up for me. So what are some of your concerns around kind of this amelioration technique, I guess, or a set of techniques or something like that? So what are the concerns that you have here?
Technique is the right word because it's not housed inside of a whole system of thinking. It's like, try this, try that. What I usually frame when I have a concern about something is I frame it errors that underlie what they're working on. So one of the errors that I think is really embedded in this is that trust, which is what they say, you know, you're really trying to build, not to have people be psychologically afraid. They're assuming is something that must be contextually created and then I'll feel safe. Whereas trust is actually a process of something I learn to trust myself. Each person learns to trust themselves to be resilient, to figure it out, to be present, and they're building a character, kind of a stamina for the kind of things that throw them in life. And one of the things I think is really important, you know, like when you're raising children, is you let them get exposed to kinds of things that are difficult, and then you work with them to figure it out, but you don't try and manipulate them not feeling, you don't try and go protect them. This is a protective mindset. This is a fostering an increased amount of reactivity. Now, where does that come from? They even in this article talk about the part of our brain, which is called the reptilian brain, has a tendency to want to run and hide. And they're trying to keep you from having the reptilian brain get triggered. The real concern I have is that all of this is really a capability. It's not a condition. So what I mean by that is we all have reptilian brains. We all have a reactivity, but we grow up in a world where if we're educated, if we're developed, if we're given reflective opportunities, we build the capacity to manage that reactivity. We begin to say, is what the warning I'm getting, the fear I'm getting, a real thing? Is it going to make any difference? Now, a business is a great way to develop that because you can ask, you don't want to create the conditions where you're trying to lay people off all the time and you're threatening people. Obviously, I'm not talking about letting those things be in existence. But if what you're doing is constantly working to prevent people from being able to be self-reflective and developing the capacity, you're not building whole human beings. So the underlying premise that bothers me about this article is rather than giving the capacity of what's called the human, the neocortex, the more human brain, a capacity to manage all of this, is it's not being developed. Instead, we're just preventing the fear and ameliorating whatever fear people might happen. So my foundational argument against this one is when we talk about psychological safety and trust, it's really a capability challenge. It's not a conditioned challenge. It's not something managers should manage for people. Now, how do you do that? Well, my big hint, and it's not something you run out and do tomorrow, but we've designed organizations so we don't develop people. We throw people into deep water and see if they can swim as a, usually a way of testing them. What you really want to do is build an ongoing, regular, recurring developmental process that works not just on what people can do, but how do they manage their being? How do they manage their reactions and responses to things that are going on around them? The way you do that is by having people reflect on experiences they've had and ask how it worked. And then you introduce more material to them, like let them be able to see when they tend to be reactive, which is what this entire article is about. It's trying to avoid people being reactive rather than giving people the capacity to learn to manage that. Now, why does that matter? Why does it matter to you as a manager? Your favorite question. People interpret the things that are going on around them from their managers, from their coworkers, from people who are higher in the organization. They interpret it based on the kind of state of being that they're in. If they're in a fearful state, whatever happens will feel fearful. You trying to change all the outside conditions doesn't give them more strength to withstand those as customers change, as markets change, as the stock market goes crazy and affects your company, as competitors step in with things. Those are where you really want that reptilian brain paying attention. What is it that we need to pay attention to in the marketplace? The exciting thing is that people can learn to manage their own thinking, their own worldview, and their own reactions, and therefore be able to interpret what they see going on around them. It's not about teaching managers little techniques to keep them safe.
Got it. That's helpful. So then how do you come to understand people if not by making the environment safer, as the authors suggest? What would you do instead?
Well, I think I was giving the beginning of that, talking about creating a developmental process. The real foundation, if it's a capability challenge, and many things I see in Harvard Business Review and other places are, here, managers, here's what you can do to make it work for your people. There is really no appropriate role for managers in that way. What I would say is step up to the idea that we don't need someone at a higher level telling people what to do. Now, I don't go get rid of hierarchies. I mean, I have built companies without them, and there are people who eventually decide they don't need them. But I changed the roles that what previous supervisors and managers were playing to become resources to those people in capability building. Now, I'm not talking about coaching and mentoring only. I'm talking about them giving people an opportunity to commit to do something, either offered to them or something the person came up with, and then working side by side on making sure they have the support, the kind of learning, the kind of introduction to the things that it takes. But most important, here's the number one role that you switch resources to. Rather than trying to give them something you want feedback on and find how they did and find another way to do it so they aren't scared, you ask them, where did you get scared? Where did you get confused? Where did the fear step in? And you can introduce ways for have them become internally reflective and internally able to create a way to figure their way through it. I call that offering people a framework that's different than the mental model they have in their head. You know, mental models are things we're stuck about the way we see it. And some of them are just crazy. They come from, I had a father who was authoritarian and all I need is one authoritarian guy or gal to step up and I'm back arguing with my father. Well, I'm not suggesting that we're going to try and do therapy, but you can create a way for people to reflect on those things rather than try and manage it so that even when that happens, they overcome their fear. So education and changing the role that supervisors and managers play so that people become more responsible on their own for the kind of things that are difficult and challenging. And then you've now changed the work design where the supervisor is not critiquing, no performance review, no evaluation, no rewards, no recognition. Instead, they are the capability builder.
We'll be right back. So, Carol, where does this idea of psychological safety, where does this come from?
You know, I have a feeling. I think about the entrepreneurs that I knew some years ago. They were mostly craftspeople, you know, a very long time ago. They were like in a local area. And if you think about it, even the early days of the United States, there were people who were making bowls of silver and chests and leather goods, and they made them for really specific people. And so you were relating to where the real use of the reptilian brain goes. Is this something I'm doing that's going to keep me safe within the community I'm a part of? But as we started to build power structures where you have hierarchies that people don't know who is going to make choices, they don't know how the rules are going to change, and you no longer have your neighbor who is buying something from you, and so you can feel the direct relationship, I think fear set in. And then we added to that breaking apart jobs so that now I have a small piece of something, and I can't tell what the whole looks like, and so I keep my head down, and I pay a lot of attention to small pieces. Now, we've been doing that for 100, close to 200 years now. So we have wiped out that natural kind of experience people have where fear should be something about what we're serving. And I don't even think it needs to be fear, but awareness, paying attention. The Industrial Revolution, you know, really distanced from users, from the effects we have on them. And then I think it was compounded by John Watson's work with behavioral psychology, where he said people are like rats in a maze, and you want to be able to manage them with incentives and rewards. And so we got used to and believed that that was the only way to do it, was to manipulate people. So no wonder trust is broken down. We have stopped developing the capability. We remove people and distance them from the ones that they're really serving, which is a lot of what I try and turn around. And then we also have instilled manipulative processes, all of which come out of the study of rats. So that's how we got here.
We'll be right back. I want to remind everyone about how to participate in the show by joining in our quiz on SurveyMonkey each week. This is where you can find and offer articles for review from HBR or other popular business written media. Search for Business Second Opinion online or in your favorite podcast place like Stitcher or iTunes. It's more fun to listen when you can participate. To get educated about Carol's approach to critiquing popular ideas, download her chapter at www.businesssecondopinion.com. Plus, there's a weekly drawing for a free copy of Carol's new book, The Regenerative Business, for all those who participate in the quiz, write comments, or article recommendations. And Carol's going to give a shout out to those who get it mostly right. So Carol, once again, we have some questions from subscribers, and I have some questions for you as well. So I'm going to dive into some of those, if that's okay.
Sure.
So the first one here that I want to dig into is, are there any organizations that you know of at this point that have trust kind of embedded in their DNA or embedded in how they work?
Oh, absolutely. It's easier when they're smaller. So I'm going to give you one quick example that's actually, you can see a more in-depth version of this in the new book, The Regenerative Business, which is called Food Inspiration, or the overarching corporate name is Shoot My Food, because they work in the food industry, food service industry, and they create media, including magazines, and shoot pictures of all of that. They have developed systems whereby they hire mostly people coming straight out of school, and they ask them to take on major projects which would transform the food service industry, particularly in the Netherlands where they are. But they now are reaching out more across all of Europe and getting people to really see the inspiration that comes from having people be able to self-initiate. They've got two or three things working right now where you have someone who has just come out of school, usually in the food hospitality industry, and they're actually asked to create a program that would be something like getting young people to become heavily involved and redefining how we think about food. And they'll put on an event that invites and brings together these young people who are watching what's happening with food, watching everything from like the restaurant experience to the growing of food, and help to redefine that, or to write blogs that whole process is immediately awakening the inspiration, the innovation, and it's bringing more and more people to want to work for them, but also it's bringing new customers who are so excited about what they see happening. And I sit and listen to people say that on how to work with millennials, and I think, just head over to Amsterdam and have a conversation with Food Inspiration, because the thing that comes out of that is people trust themselves. The kids get to play in the dirt, and they develop an immune system which can manage the fear and the shortfalls, and believe there's no such thing as failure because there's another place to step up and go immediately. So yeah, that's one example, and there are a lot more. That's why I make 15 stories in each of my books I write, so you can see how it works.
Got it. Thank you. So the author of this article also makes a pretty linear argument that safety leads to trust, which leads to creativity through two cognitive processes she identifies, solution finding and divergent thinking. So can you speak a little about where you believe creativity comes from, which I think a lot of people talk about innovation and creativity in organizations big and small. So where you think creativity comes from, because that seems to be the linchpin of her argument. So
first, I don't agree with those are the sources of it, because both of those come out of trying to improve on existence. So you think about divergent thinking, we diverge here and then we go there and we go there and we go there. And you're not actually starting from what I call the essence thinking of something. If you don't ask what is at the heart of this business, this company, this challenge, then what you're doing is building off of what you already know. Same thing is true for puzzle solutions. We have been conditioned to think that we always have to define the problem. That by definition and grounds us in where we are. Now, how do you go to innovation from when you are starting with where you are? That's not how I think that you really, and we'll bring it back to trust in a second. But you start with asking the question, like what really is a, if you're DuPont and you're using your essence, you ask, what really is the essence of safe farm fishing? Interesting that they're both about safety. But you have to ask, what makes that work? And you don't start with defining what's the problem, because then what you're going to do is solve one piece of it. If you start with essence, you're more likely to get a really exciting new idea, because you're asking what really is being driven by that. The idea that safety produces trust is backwards to me. Trust and being able to trust myself, having learned and built the capability to be resilient, to be creative, to start with something and figure out where to go, is what will create me feeling safe. If I don't feel like I can manage me in whatever conditions come up, there is nothing you can do to make it completely safe for me. That's like still, again, trying to raise children so that we protect them and then somehow they'll feel safe and they can innovate. No, it turns out it's not true. They're actually building schoolyards now that are full of risks, because we spent so many years removing all risk from a schoolyard that kids don't know how to respond when they get into a place that they don't know how to manage. They've never figured out how to work on it. So that linear argument is so backwards. I have built organizations for years where individuals take on what I call promises beyond ableness. That's the source of innovation, where they look at what's going on, not internal, because you have to move this from being employee-centric to being market-centric. You look at what's going on in your customers' and your consumers' lives, and you ask, what will enliven them? Where could they go? And you start to work on it, and you have everything go wrong. You have something that doesn't work, and then you have to figure that out, and you have to go get a team, and you have to raise the internal funds to do it, and you probably have to figure out how to work with a customer who's unhappy with you, and you have to not run away and not hide. That process of learning how to do that, I call a promise beyond ableness, because people commit to do it even when they don't know how. That's the process of building trust in oneself. Now, when I do that, I can take a bigger risk and a next bigger risk, and I don't need my managers trying to manage the environment and keep me from getting upset and thrown. No, I want to take on something really big. That process is what I think is the linear direction from trust of self and ability to manage self straight into innovation.
So there's another follow-up point here that the author makes that I want to take a second to dig into, which is about something you mentioned earlier around these human-to-human conversations, right? So she talks about how they end up ultimately aiming towards having whoever I'm in a conversation with appear kind of quote-unquote just like me. So that actually seems like a great angle, but I have a feeling you're going to take umbrage with this idea. So I figure I'll just kind of cut us all off at the pass and have you dig into it right now.
I think the intention, again, is good. They're trying to dehierarchize something artificially. I suggest that there is a more direct route that is a capability building route to get there rather than just trying to see this other person as wanting to succeed, wanting to be happy, just like you want to be happy and trying to level the playing field. I call it self to self, but I mean something radically different, which is there is no hierarchy. We are now collectively sitting side by side using a framework that will allow us both to start from zero and figure out how to co-create this together rather than a manager coming in and trying to believe that they're just like you. If you've still got the they're assigning or delegating or evaluating what you're doing, but trying to do it in a human way and saying to themselves, oh yeah, I remember, they're just like me, just like me. You haven't really shifted the worldview and you haven't shifted the way to work. So when I get people to sit down, I teach them, first we change the role of what we're supervisors and managers. We don't get rid of them. We've done that in every company I'm in. You change that role. But instead, what you do is have them create something together. That's a capability building process. Process for something external to the company, i.e. a customer, a market, some significant new initiative you want to take on. I mean, I'm working with Orchard Supply right now, and they're looking at how do they shift so much more of what they do to more of a community feeling, a sense of having a membership in something. And instead of having managers managing that top down, you create a cross-cultural group that comes from all of the people who would need to be in it, not all of them, but reflections from all of those aspects. And you have them work on co-creating something through a framework. I can't stress how important, and I talk a bit more about how framework thinking works, that disrupts your normal patterns of thinking for both of you. Now you're really in it together, and you're self-to-self trying to figure out how to go there, how to make it work. And we're not only trying to figure out how you and I are like each other, but how we're in this together to make it work for the customer. So you move from that internal trying to manage stuff to co-creating something with market-centric. I don't think you can get to innovation, certainly not from trying to ameliorate things for people so they feel safe.
Yeah, that subtle perspective shift is actually quite helpful. So the last question that I have here, the author also encourages us to use surveys to measure psychological safety. I wanted you to just talk a little bit in this context about how you view surveys and their usefulness.
There's not much usefulness in any form, whether it's market surveys, certainly not culture surveys. And again, I have another small book on surveys and particularly culture surveys, which is what they're suggesting here. So you try and find it internally how people are feeling. So what's the problem with that? What it does is have a third party, and I call us third party America sometimes because we do everything with a third party, goes and interviews people and takes what they think they said and run it through an algorithm that averages it, makes it a commodified understanding. The kind of research that we've done at the Carol Sanford Institute, we asked people who were surveyed during something to look at what the summary was and ask if they can still see themselves in it. The interesting thing is between 80 and 90% of people can't find what they said that's reported in the survey. And you go one more level where you not only have the survey given to the marketing or sales team or whoever it was, but then you give it down to people in the organization and ask them to do something with it. And you have whatever they did go back to the people who did the survey and say, did that solve your problem? They said, I have no idea. I wasn't talking about anything like that. So the dismembering, the disconnecting from a survey to real people who can act on it is where a real fault happens. You get first, you lose what people said, and secondly, you give it to people who didn't hear it, and you expect them to have fully interpreted it. So getting rid of all the third parties is maybe one of the most important things about creating safety and creating innovation, which this article was about, and putting people directly back in place. Now, the hint about what we do is we create field teams which are directly connected to the market. Not you have marketing people on those teams, you have salespeople on them, you have operation, whether it's manufacturing or IT, design or engineering, whatever you have that mix of people who are stewarding directly the market. And you go through a process of learning how to do that, learn to image. And now you can have real innovation and you don't have this dismemberment of the ideators to the people who are trying to do execution.
Carol, I appreciate these conversations so much. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
You're welcome.
Do you want to suggest articles for Carol to review, pose questions for her to answer, or even argue with her response and get a second opinion? Become a member at www.businesssecondopinion.com. Subscribe and review this podcast to win a copy of her new book or a poster of readers' favorite quotes from the book. Also, subscribe to the blog that accompanies the podcast and the newsletter that keeps you up to speed on what's coming next. Join us next Thursday, where Carol's going to dig into consciousness and mindfulness in the workplace in an article by Daniel Goleman. Thanks so much. This has been Business Second Opinion.